This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director Alicia Graf Mack. Plus, five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org.
My name is Eva. I'm 5 years old. How fast do butterflies fly?
I'm Musa and I'm 2 years old. Do caterpillars go wings in the cocoon?
Do butterflies like to eat some chocolate?
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the top local stories of the day. But first, when we think about all that helps flowers bloom in the spring, most of us picture bees and butterflies. But they're not the only ones doing the work. Across the Midwest, there's a whole cast of underdog pollinators. I'm talking flies, beetles, even moths, quietly keeping ecosystems going. Wildlife drives about 80% of pollination worldwide. So, what role do these overlooked insects play here at home? We're going to ask an entomologist. But before we do, Linnea Dominic is here. She produced this episode. Hey, Linnea, good to see you.
Good to see you
too,
Sasha.
It's been a while since I've had you in the chair.
It has been a while.
And of course, you're back because we're talking about something interesting. One of your, your ideas just keep getting better and better. But we focus this time on these peculiar pollinators. Why?
I think it's really important to understand the role we all play in our ecosystems. And for me personally, when I think about a fly and it's in my home, I want it out. But it's important for me personally, and I think there's a lot we can learn about, oh, there's actually a role it plays or something beneficial it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not the fly in my home, but all the different kinds of flies that are buzzing around a garden, they are doing useful things sometimes. And if we don't know that and we're not aware of the role that all of these animals are playing, then we don't care if they're dying from insecticides. We don't care if they're dying off. And we don't think about how important they are in the food chain and how important they are for making sure that we have blooming trees, blooming flowers, like crops.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought that up because it is kind of a split second decision when you see that bee or that fly that's gotten in through your window and you're thinking, I've got to find something to like help shoo it out the door. But yeah, they're here for a reason.
Yeah, even if we don't have to like them necessarily, but I do think it helps to understand the role that they play.
Yeah, and so I had some really helpful co-hosts.
Yes.
Let's call them that. We had some kitties on the program today.
Did.
Where'd that idea come from? That was so cute.
It was great. Senior producer Meha Ahmed and I were talking about this conversation yesterday, and she's like, we have to have kids. Kids are bug experts. You know, they're not an entomologist, but they are playing with bugs. They're outside. They're like more on their level. They're shorter. They're thinking about them all the time. The creepy crawlers are coming out. You know, a lot of adults are afraid of bugs. Some kids are too, but a lot of kids have a fascination.
They're go right up close.
Yeah. And so we decided, let's go right to the source and really get to know what kinds of questions they have.
Yeah. Well, they're going to get their questions answered in this episode. Also, something else I failed to mention that I should probably mention now so folks know, the Nature Museum is hosting a conservation celebration on Thursday. This Thursday, 1 to 4 p.m., you can bring your kids and they can get hands-on experience learning about conservation with resident scientists. So, I mean, what else? What else
I'm
can we offer?
I'm taking my nieces and nephews. Let's go.
Sounds like a great idea. Let's dig into this conversation, shall we?
Let's do it.
At the table was Alan Lawrence, who's Associate Curator of Entomology for the Peggy Notarbart Nature Museum. Now, Alan started us off with more on why the more peculiar pollinators don't get as much credit.
When people think of pollinators, they tend to think of bees, which are very important pollinators.
Yeah, but there's some unsung heroes in there too, right?
Especially flies and moths are really underappreciated and, in fact, responsible for quite a lot of pollination.
We got some help from some WBEZ kids who are super bug enthusiasts, and they've got some questions for you. So let's hear the first one.
I am Lucy, and I am 8. My question is, why do we need pollinators?
Why do we need pollinators? Good question, Lucy.
That is a great question. We need pollinators because plants depend on them. Without them, they can't reproduce. They can't produce seeds or fruit if they're the type of plant that depends on pollinators. In 2019, there was a study that evaluated the top 105 crops and about 70 or that benefited from insect pollination. They account for about $80 billion or more globally in economic activity. 77% of those were pollinated both by bees and non-bee pollinators, accounting for over $780 billion. So quite important. I mean, our food, we wouldn't have much to eat if it weren't for pollinators.
Yeah, and make that clear to the person who may not fully understand. What exactly is happening during pollination?
So pollination is the process in which an animal carries, well, it doesn't have to be an animal, but we're talking about pollinators today, carries a grain of pollen from the anther of a flower to the female reproductive part, and that allows reproduction to happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, pollination isn't an insect's, you know, it's not their main task. It's a byproduct of them actually eating, but unintentionally, I think they ensure that the flowers and the plants get what they need, right? So it's this sort of beautiful exchange when you think about it. About how the cycle works and how mutually beneficial the species are.
Yeah, there's really a co-evolutionary relationship between these plants and their pollinators. The plants will produce nectar, which is a reward to draw in those pollinators, the sweet sugary fluid that they like to eat. Also, the pollen itself can be a good nutrition source full of protein for the pollinators. So it's really mutually beneficial for both.
Absolutely. Let's hear from Lucy again. She's got a follow-up question for you, Alan.
All right.
Why isn't every bug a pollinator?
That is a wonderful question. It really depends on the life history of the insect, basically how it lives its life. If an insect visits flowers, it's more likely to be a pollinator. So if they feed on nectar or pollen, they're going to be drawn to flowers. Their bodies need to be able to carry pollen. So either the pollen can stick to it or they have hairs that can trap that pollen.
Mm-hmm.
And then they actually have to carry that to another flower. So if they don't visit more than one flower, even if they gather pollen, they might not be an effective pollinator. So all the insects that are predators eating other insects or decomposers living, you know, on the surface of the soil or underground, they're not going to be on flowers, so they're not going to be pollinating.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the role of the bees and the butterflies and hummingbirds, right? Because they're more popular than the other pollinators, but is it just that we just know more about them, or are they actually doing more of the lion's share of the work?
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Okay.
Bees are incredible pollinators because they pollinate just a wide variety of crops, and their behavior really makes them good pollinators. They will often visit the same kind of flower multiple times in a row, so they're really transferring that pollen directly from flower to flower. But it also depends on the shapes of the flowers of the different plants. Some favor bees, some favor other insects.
Yeah. Now, we got a few questions about the speed of pollinators. Let's listen.
I'm Kareem. I'm 9 years old. And my question is, why are hummingbirds fast?
That's a good question. A little outside my wheelhouse, I focus on things that don't have backbones. But what allows them to be so fast is how they're able to beat their wings so fast. And that helps them so that they can hover in the air as they're drinking nectar from flowers with their long beaks and really long tongues.
And Zev also wanted to know how fast butterflies are.
Ooh, off the top of my head, I can't give you an answer, but surprisingly fast, especially when butterflies might be trying to escape from you. They are very acrobatic. If you watch them fly through the air, yeah, they're not just flying in one direction. They're dropping, they're swooping, they're flipping. They're doing all sorts of maneuvers.
Absolutely. And here's Oren.
My name is Oren, and I'm 5 years old. I have a question. Do hummingbirds hum?
Oh, so do hummingbirds hum? What I believe the hum in the name is referring to is the sort of buzz you can hear from their wings flapping so quickly. Mm-hmm. Not that they're making like a with their voice, but rather their wings.
Yes. Oh, interesting. Some of the kids who gave us questions are clued into the fact that there are other pollinators. I want to play a question from Simon, who's 7 years old.
How does an American fig wasp get pollen into its eggs for its babies?
Wow, Simon.
Yeah, fig wasps have a really interesting and complicated life cycle. They're the only pollinators of figs, and they depend on figs to complete their life cycle.
So he's asking how does it get pollen into its eggs for its babies?
Yeah.
Is that right?
So what the babies need to eat is going to be inside of the fig. So the wasp will climb into the fig. The fruit develops sort of to help raise the wasps and help them get pollinated.
Oh, wow.
And the flowers are sort of internal inside of that fig. So that's how they sort of pollinate inside there.
Oh, that is very interesting. Very interesting. And tell me more about, like, what is going on with wasps? Speaking of wasps, because some research is showing that they might be able to step in when there aren't enough bees.
Yeah, no, wasps are great pollinators and really underappreciated for that. They really like sweet things. They like to drink nectar. So you're going to get wasps visiting a lot of plants that bees also pollinate as well. And when wasps are visiting flowers, they're really focused on gathering that pollen and nectar to eat. So they're going to leave you alone.
Mm-hmm. Sticking with our peculiar pollinators, let's talk about moths. They're nocturnal pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more.
Yeah, so nocturnal pollinators are really underappreciated. This is where we're missing a lot of data to know, you know, flies, moths, things that fly at night. How much do we depend on those? Most of our data comes from during the day. It's just easier to catch and identify things at that time.
Some studies show that they might be faster than butterflies at pollinating.
Yeah, in general, moths, I'm sure, are much more important pollinators than butterflies on the whole. Their bodies are a bit more robust. They're fuzzier, so they can hold more pollen. And there are a lot of plants that bloom at night, release floral, you know, their good smells at night to attract those moths at that time of day.
Interesting that you said the moths are more important than the butterflies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of moths, little tiny brown moths that maybe we don't even look at or pay attention to that are doing these ecosystem services for us.
Wow. Beetles, too. They're known for eating flowers, but they can also help pollinate.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah. Depends on the type of beetle, type of plant. A good example are magnolias. They have a really primitive flower that's big, wide, and open. They provide ample pollen. So beetles can crawl in there, get all this pollen, cover their bodies. So beetles are possibly, you know, the first pollinators that we had out of the water.
Mm. Wow. And spiders. Not my favorite, but they're beneficial too, right?
Yeah, spiders are definitely beneficial because they'll eat, you know, pest insects. They do some pest control for us. Some of them hang around flowers to use them as a lure to catch insects that fly close and then they can grab them. But they're not generally going to be going from flower to flower.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to be doing as much pollination, but they might do some incidentally.
Interesting. And I teased flies earlier. Let's talk about them. What should we know about their role here in helping flowers bloom for the spring?
Oh, yeah. Flies, I believe, are incredibly underappreciated. There are these little flies called syrphids or hoverflies. Growing up...
Do they look different than the regular fly that just...
They look kind of like bees, and they hover in the air. They're black and yellow striped.
Oh.
Those are really important pollinators. And then as larvae, some of them eat aphids and other pests, so they're really beneficial to have around in all life stages.
Mm-hmm. What plants are these pollinators attracted to?
Yeah,
typically?
Well... We want to talk about our spring ephemerals. We have Virginia bluebell that's pollinated by a variety of things, including bumblebees, hummingbirds, butterflies, and moths.
Mm-hmm.
Jack in the pulpit is a really fun one. Those have kind of a stinky smell if you get up close and smell the flowers, and they attract gnats and beetles.
Interesting. And a lot of these underdogs that we're talking about, like the moths and the wasps and the beetles, they're keeping pest populations in check. So does that support pollination efforts?
Yeah, because if you have too many pests, they could eat the plants, and then there's not as many floral resources available for the pollinators.
Butterflies and bees, what do we know about their populations here in the Chicago area? Last I heard, I mean, their rates are declining.
Yeah. So at the Peggy Nobart Nature Museum, we run a community science program, the Illinois Butterfly Monitoring Network. So we've been tracking butterfly populations throughout the state for, we're entering our 40th monitoring season now. And yeah, we have been recording declines over the last few decades. So it is a bit of a bummer, but yes. Now that we have this data, we can try and start to do something about it.
And you spoke there about the 40th monitoring season. Did you sort of commemorate that earlier this month?
Yeah, we just had our annual meeting. Okay. We have a winter gathering every year where we sort of recap the last season, jazz everyone up for the upcoming season. We also hit another milestone last year. We counted our 1 millionth butterfly in the history of the program.
Amazing. Congratulations. Now we've got our little ones. They still have lots of butterfly questions. So let's hear this one from James about migration.
My name is James and I am 6. I'm going to ask you how butterflies go from Mexico to Chicago.
How do butterflies go from Mexico to Chicago?
Yeah, so this question is about the monarch's migration northward, returning from Mexico. So this time of year, they've started to take off. They've left Mexico. They're going to make it to about Texas.
And this is when it typically starts, butterfly migration?
Yeah, in March is when they'll take off and start returning north. They'll make it to Texas. They're going to encounter milkweed and start to mate and lay their eggs on it, and they're going to die. They're not going to make it much further than that. Those eggs will hatch out into caterpillars. They'll go through their whole life cycle. And then the butterflies that emerge from them, they will fly further northward. And some of them will start to make it to Chicago.
Yeah. And we just talked about we're seeing declining rates of it. That makes me sad.
Yeah. Although we had some good news. The population counts of monarch butterflies in Mexico just came out, you know, a couple weeks ago. And their numbers are up 64% compared to last year, which we kind of predicted looking at the numbers from the summer season of monarchs. We were hoping the numbers would be up.
Yes.
It's still not a ton, but it's a good improvement.
That's positive news.
Yep.
Now, the Illinois Butterfly Monitoring Network that you just spoke about, talk about folks, because you need help, right? Can people reach out? Can they volunteer?
Yeah,
how
absolutely.
Can they help you guys with this mission?
So this is a community science project, so we're basically completely run with volunteers. So if you just go to our website, ibmn.org, there's an apply now button. You just need to attend one training session. We have 3 more introductory training sessions. Just go to one and you'll learn how to follow our data collection protocol, how to identify local butterfly species. Mm-hmm. And then you'll be assigned a route in a natural area and you walk that route 6 times throughout the season and report back on every butterfly you see within 20 feet.
That is incredible. You're doing really important work, data and analysis, right? I'm looking at some of the recent findings from the Illinois Butterfly Monitoring Network, including, you know, like we talked about, the declines of butterfly abundance here in North America, the role of insecticides in trending is declining, and how land management can help mitigate butterfly loss.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, our data has been combined with other data sources to do nationwide and regional analyses on butterfly declines and what factors are causing them. So in the Midwest, it's found that pesticides are a big culprit, especially neonicotinoids. But now that we have some proof, maybe we can start to do something about that. And climate change is also another factor. It kind of affects their seasonality, when they're active, what times of year. And we found that habitat management can help mitigate those effects so that there's less variability in when they're out. And it can really, you know, either slow down or reverse declines at local sites.
Are you accepting kid volunteers too?
We accept kid volunteers if they are accompanied by a parent.
Okay, that'll do it. We'll leave it there. Alan Lawrence is Associate Curator of Entomology at the Peggy Nobart Nature Museum. Thank you for answering all of our questions.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, kids, for submitting your questions as well.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Time now for a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. From the sheer number of jobs that we're expecting through the effort to replace toxic lead pipes across the city, to the Supreme Court weighing in on when we vote by mail, to a rare win this season for the Chicago Bulls. At the table, Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, and WBEZ reporters Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco and Araceli Gomez-Aldana. Araceli started off with an update on the top story across the country. What's the latest on ICE agents helping TSA at airports? Here's Araceli.
Colleagues and I, we were out at the airports yesterday, early morning, and we were just kind of looking out. And of course, I was at Midway, and I didn't see any ICE agents at Midway, but our colleagues were at O'Hare, and they saw at least a half dozen agents, and they were wearing ICE gear. They were at all the terminals, Terminal 1, 2, 3. They were just kind of standing around.
Mm-hmm.
They're here in Chicago. Of course, we know that CNN reported they were going to be at 14 different airports. I was thinking they would go maybe where there's a lot of lines,
right?
You know, but I mean, they're here in Chicago, and I didn't see a lot of long lines at Midway. I didn't see any ICE agents. Things were going pretty smoothly.
Somehow,
over there.
I'm not surprised that they showed up in Chicago,
yeah,
though. Long lines or not, I mean, and what are they supposed to be doing? We've been hearing that they're supposed to be helping TSA.
Mm-hmm.
Is it helping TSA or is it immigration enforcement? Because in every image I've seen, including my own trip to the airport yesterday, which we'll get into in just a moment.
Okay.
They're just standing around.
Yeah, it's hard to tell what they're supposed. We've asked, what are they supposed to be doing? What is the role? How will they be assisting TSA? And it really is just, you know, what we've seen is they were just kind of standing around,
yeah,
and monitoring things. Of course, I'm not really sure what they're doing. Like, for example, in Atlanta, where there are really long lines,
right,
like how can they help and assist in that case? I did, off the record, talk to a TSA agent that was just kind of walking around, and I was like, hey, why are there no long lines here in Chicago? And we see long lines in other places. And he just basically said, well, we show up to work. We are still showing up to work, even,
yes,
though we're not getting paid. We're still here. That's not the case in a lot of airports. So, you know, I feel like I don't know what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and I can co-sign that too, because
yeah,
I remember Friday when I was flying out from O'Hare, I got through. I mean, I have pre-check, but I got through in 10 minutes.
Really easy.
The line, and even the general boarding line seemed to be moving quickly. What are you seeing,
yeah,
Claire?
Well, we've been seeing, just reporting on Morning Edition, that some of these lines have been 5 hours.
Right.
We
oh, yeah,
saw Houston, big problems. This was even related to the crash involving the fire truck at LaGuardia Airport,
mm-hmm,
that shut down that airport,
mm-hmm,
yesterday.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The person who was there to investigate that was stuck in a TSA line in Houston.
Wow.
Special calls even had to be made to get that person 5 hours.
Wow.
To even invest. So it's impacting lots of things. It's a trickle-down effect. But we've,
yeah,
been told that a lot of these ICE agents are doing things like reminding folks to remove any liquids out of their carry-ons.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, yesterday, flying back to Chicago, I was flying, mm-hmm, out of Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport, and that's where I saw the ICE agents. This was about 8 in the morning, and they were there unmasked,
mm-hmm,
which was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I saw faces for the first time.
Yeah.
And just standing there, just hands on their vests, just kind of in just,
yeah,
like, you know, relaxed pose at each of the lanes. Just one ICE agent per lane kind,
yeah,
of thing. And they weren't saying a thing. You know, TSA was still sort of the ones giving instructions, and it was strange. And then what was even more strange was, as I got through security and got to the gate, there were TSA agents at the gate, lined across the gate, three of them. And then when it was time for us to board, it was six of them with a machine to do additional screening before you got on the plane. And so they stood there across, you know, you're sitting, picture,
yeah,
you're sitting there at the gate waiting for your flight. Six TSA agents just like standing there, kind of intimidating us.
Yeah.
because I saw folks next to me, you know, calling family members like, I don't know what's going on right now. Just kind of whispering. You don't know if you can speak. They're staring at you. And it was chaotic.
Yeah. Because the airport isn't already fun enough.
I know.
And by that point, you know, when you get to the gate, that's supposed to be the part where you kind of relax. Because it's now you just wait to get on the plane and fall asleep, hopefully, if you're one of those who can sleep on flights.
It is interesting that they're wearing uniform. Some of them are masked, some of them aren't. Like, I was looking through the Associated Press pictures of just across the country. And, you know, there are some that they're not wearing masks. And then there's people like in Houston, the ICE agents were wearing masks. Here in Chicago, they were wearing masks. So it is kind of... Yeah. Who's telling them what to do?
And they're common. I mean, you do have federal immigration agents at airports all over the world, but mostly you see them when it comes to international travel, like Terminal 5 usually, because they're checking for things like food from foreign countries, potential smuggling, things like that. But what you're seeing, Sasha, is very uncommon.
That's very uncommon. Different.
Yeah.
Very different.
And, you know, the announcement of you could be randomly called to be screened again. That kind of put some people on edge. And I felt bad. I was also nervous. Knowing good well I had nothing to hide, I was like, what is this going to be about? Am I going to be one of the random people? Yeah. And Juan Pablo, this all makes me think of the fact that we've got TSA agents, as we've talked about, who are going unpaid, right? Mm-hmm. Standing next to these paid ICE agents. Isn't that a strange sort of juxtaposition there?
It's totally weird. And when you see like the numbers of them in there, it kind of even is a little bit more startling. But Arcelia, you said a question which was like, where's the guidance coming from on what they're supposed to be doing? Well, President Trump actually posted on social media yesterday. He asked ICE agents, don't wear masks. Mm-hmm. Just do not wear masks while working at airports. Even so, like you mentioned, the results have been pretty mixed.
Yeah, very mixed.
We're seeing some... It's interesting because in some cases we do see the faces for the first time.
Right, yeah.
It's totally weird. But in other cases, we're still seeing masks.
Anything from Mayor Johnson yet on what's going on?
Yeah, there's been a lot of local reaction. Mayor Brandon Johnson and Governor J.B. Pritzker decrying the deployment of any ICE agents unnecessarily, especially at O'Hare. Mayor Johnson saying in a statement that his office was using every tool that they have to ensure that people, no matter what their immigration status is, can travel without any harassment. And JB weighing in as well, saying that immigration agents at airports are causing chaos and instilling fear. And to your point, just raising eyebrows, making people feel uncomfortable.
Absolutely. Any word, Araceli, on how long this could go or if Trump is planning to send more agents?
We are not sure, but we, of course, are hearing President Trump said yesterday that he's even considering the National Guard to come assist at security airports. There has been mention from the White House border czar, Tom Homan, who said, hey, let's just send people where they need the most help. So the longest lines at different airports. But there is no word about whether the National Guard will be here as well.
Claire, a Chicago man has been charged with threatening violence on social media. What did he say?
Yes, threatening most recently to carry out a shooting at a synagogue. Authorities say this is 31-year-old Timothy Holmes posted the threat earlier this month on X in response to a post about the death of Iran's supreme leader. Further investigation had revealed that Holmes had made two other previous threats on social media against Israeli officials.
Mm. Where is he now?
So the Sun-Times reporting that Holmes was arrested while traveling in Florida on March 18th, but then he was released on bond. He was ordered not to possess firearms or weapons and may not access any social media or chat-based platforms while his case is still pending.
And Juan Pablo, you're here now, and it makes me think of the fact that you are always keeping an eye on the replacement of toxic lead pipes in Chicago. So I couldn't bring you on the Daily News update without asking you about the latest information, because it looks like the effort could be a job creator, too.
It sure does. Yeah, that's right. That's at least the argument of a recent report from four Chicago area nonprofits. The argument goes that replacing lead pipes is very expensive. For example, some estimates have it that replacing all of Illinois' lead pipes could cost like something in the ballpark of $10 billion.
Ooh.
So we're talking a lot of money, right?
Wow.
But the idea is that if managed correctly, those billions of dollars could mean a bunch of jobs.
Oh. How many jobs are we talking about?
I'm so glad you asked. The report says that the funding for lead pipes could mean creating something like 90,000 jobs over a decade. And that could be like plumbers, pipe fitters, operating engineers, think laborers, and like even community outreach coordinators, like you name it, all sorts of roles.
Lots of different jobs. Lots of flexibility there too. What's the update on where we are with replacing all of these lead pipes across the city?
Yeah. You know, Illinois' bill is so high because the state has so many lead pipes.
Is it still going slowly?
It's going. It's certainly going. You know, we've got chart-topping numbers here. Illinois has something like 1.5 million lead pipes. That's like some of the highest numbers nationwide. What I would say is that we're chugging along. We have something like 412,000 lead pipes in the city. As of the end of last year, we replaced something like 15,000.
Oh, okay.
And so there's a lot of work to do.
A lot of work still left to be done. In other news, Araceli, Illinois' Attorney General Kwame Raoul, he stays busy. He's filed yet another lawsuit against the Trump administration.
That's right.
This one's around food assistance. So tell us what we need to know.
Yeah. And I think Raoul is just, you know, joining other states and going after what he calls a vague funding conditions from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this is because the USDA is threatening to withhold nearly $6 billion in grant dollars. So for things like school lunch and food assistance programs in Illinois, which we know are very needed here in the state. And all of this because, you know, the Trump administration is requiring states to comply with federal policies related to immigration, gender identity, and diversity as a condition for funding. And Raoul says that that should not be allowed. You cannot hold this money with these conditions. He says that he's thinking about the struggling single parent whose children may no longer have access to school lunch because of, you know, these policies that they want to uphold. I will say that this is the 57th lawsuit against the federal government from Raoul's office.
Yeah, and this is something that hits home for a lot of people, right? According to the state, 1 in 6 people rely on SNAP. So a lot of folks could be affected here.
Exactly.
Now, Claire, it's been a week since Illinois' primary election day, and folks who voted, they had the option of voting in person or voting by mail. The Supreme Court is now potentially weighing in on when we vote by mail. What's going on?
This is a big case. Illinois is part of it. Illinois and 14 other states, Supreme Court considering whether mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day should be counted at all, right? So in Illinois, the current law is it has to be postmarked by Election Day.
Right.
And then you've got a 14-day grace period for that vote to be received and then counted. But if the justices decide they should not be counted, it leaves not much time for election officials, or for people that do vote by mail to sort of adapt and adjust to what they're going to have to do come November.
And how many people would you say that is? How popular is voting by mail in Illinois?
Right. So we got some data in 2024 in Illinois, 106,000 ballots arrived within that 14-day grace period, which is just under 2% of the total votes cast. So it's not nothing.
Yeah, that's still 106,000 people.
You're talking about people with disabilities or for whatever reason that cannot physically get to the polls.
You know, as we were heading into the primaries and I was talking to people, people really like that option. Also, when people are studying in a different state, if they're in college, when people are in the military, where they live in rural areas of the state where it's not so easy. I mean, this all will be affected. I'm watching closely to see what happens. And I know that a ruling is expected in late June.
Yeah. Any other stories you're watching, Claire?
Yeah, we had the 52nd annual Non-Equity Jeff Awards last night. Mike Davis was in the house covering that event for WBEZ, and it's two Chicago theaters, the Co-Candy and Invictus, that tied for the most awards last night, each taking home 8 awards.
Nice. You got potential good news for homeowners, Juan Pablo, the folks who are tired of these rising insurance costs.
Yeah, emphasis on the potential part there.
Okay.
A home insurance reform bill made it through the Illinois House last week. And this is a big deal because insurance rates in Illinois have been skyrocketing. Between 2021 and 2024, rates shot up by something like 50% on average. This is a lot of money, something like $1,000 usually.
Yeah.
We've seen additional rate increases since then. And these rates reflect increased risks in the state thanks to climate change, according to the insurers who are asking for these rate increases. At any rate, the new legislation would empower the state to hit the brakes on these rate increases. And Governor Pritzker has been urging lawmakers to pass this legislation. They tried to do it last year. Again, this is where that emphasis comes from. They didn't get to. we'll see where it goes this year.
We're keeping a close eye because I can look. I would love to pay less for insurance, and I'm sure a lot of people would as well. Now, let's talk about some sports before you go, Araceli, because I know you were at the Bulls game.
I was.
Did they win?
They won. Okay. Can you believe it?
I'm happy because they haven't had the best season so far.
It's very true, and I was going in not very optimistic, but they went on up to 22-point lead at one point. So I was able to relax. I was like, we got this. Of course, Houston has Kevin Durant, who's a wonderful, wonderful player. They were able to, like, tie up in the fourth quarter, but it was really all about the finish, which the Bulls were able to finish. They were shooting lights out. It was great. But, you know, now they are 29-42. So it's not like we've had the best season.
Yikes.
Yeah. So it was a good win.
Chugging along, Bulls.
Keep going.
We're rooting for you. WBEZ's Araceli Gomez-Aldana, Claire Lane, and Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.